What would happen if instead of composing predetermined assignments, college composition students could compose whatever they want to compose? What would happen if students could set their own deadlines and grade their own work? Find out as Assistant Professor Mason Joyner and I explore these questions with a few of our fellow English department colleagues. I'm Monica Mankin, and this is the English 101 Experiment.
Welcome to the English 101 Experiment. My name is Mason Joyner. I am an assistant professor of English at Delgado Community College in New Orleans, Louisiana. And here is my co-host,
Monica Mankin, also professor here at Delgado Community College. And we are happy to welcome back our colleague,
Andrew Gibbs, an assistant professor at Delgado. It is a joy to be back with y'all. Thanks for inviting me.
Great to have you, Andrew.
Yeah, thanks for coming back on the podcast. To talk about, I think, something we all enjoy.
Yes.
Which is bringing literature into our classes.
I would hope so.
Our composition classroom.
I would have great questions about professors who didn't like to teach literature.
Well, we've got one.
Let's talk about one of those professors. So for this episode 2 of season 2, we are going to explore scholarship by Erica Lindman, and this is a piece published in 1993, and it's freshman composition, No Place for Literature. And I think that the title is the thesis, so I don't know how much summary is needed. Maybe we could just dive into some of the excerpts that we are interested in discussing.
Well, I guess I could start where I think she sort of states her the purpose of the essay a bit.
Okay.
This is on page 312. She says that freshman English offers guided practice in reading and writing in the discourses of the academy and the professions. That is what our colleagues across the campus want it to do. That is what it should do if we are trying to drag every first-year student through the requirement.
A student should never be dragged, Mason.
I was just going to say.
What a verb.
Way to make it sound fun.
Right.
Let's all go to college.
Right.
I also highlighted that. But I highlighted beyond that. Because I think it's important, like what she starts talking about there in that paragraph that follows. Mm-hmm. By defining the course in this way, I am excluding courses preoccupied with grammar or the essay or great ideas. As we have known for decades, focusing on grammar instruction reduces the amount of writing practice students are likely to get. Mm-hmm. Focusing exclusively on the essay, including the critical essay on a work of literature, amounts to collapsing the discourses of the academy into one genre, limiting students' abilities to practice other forms, experience other perspectives, negotiate the expectations of other readers. Andrew, do you have an excerpt that...
Yeah, I actually am going to the first page on 311.
Okay.
And I just found her beginning that teachers argue that poetry, fiction, and drama offer essential training in the process of reading. And yes, they do, but they also offer essential training in the process of understanding what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm.
Character motivations, why people do what they do,
why
people are the way they are. It allows us to understand a human's worldview, how they're shaped, and possibly even it provides opportunities to bridge the gap and connect with our fellow humans. These are noble goals that I think have a place in the freshman composition class.
Right. It seems like perhaps Lindman finds a different purpose for the freshman composition class.
Mm-hmm. But I guess, like, so maybe for our listeners, one of the things is this piece of scholarship prompted a couple other pieces of scholarship.
Sure.
One is another article by Gary Tate called A Place for Literature in Freshman Composition. Mm-hmm. And I think, Lindman defines this purpose. Let me see if I can find where. Right, this purpose of the freshman writing course, which I think we would define as WAC, mm-hmm. writing across the curriculum.
Yep.
But I think I want to look at these questions that Tate raises in his article, A Place for Literature,
yeah.
Where he says, why do we deny our students the pleasure and profit of reading this literature? Some of us don't, of course, but for many years now, we have had to use it furtively, on the sly, with cautious glances over our shoulders. Hey, kid, want to read a good poem?
Yeah, as if we're breaking the rules by introducing such things.
And then I love that he goes on to say, though, I'm not prepared to argue that imaginative literature should be the only kind of reading required of our composition students,
yeah.
nor should it be the only kind of writing they are asked to do. All I am suggesting is that we need to think seriously about why we are neglecting literature. And I love all his talk about the rhetoric police,
uh-huh.
but I think one of the things that I think might be important to note as we're maybe like responding to Lindman is Tate's point about how there wasn't really a big debate about literature's place.
Mm-hmm.
We just sort of silently surrendered to like removing it from the composition course and rhetoric took its place.
Yeah.
To me, that feels kind of important in responding to this piece by Lindman.
I agree. She goes on to say, when freshmen read and write about imaginative literature alone, they remain poorly prepared for the writing required of them in courses outside the English department. And I don't understand why she thinks that. I think
mm-hmm.
that through reading and writing about literature, you're able to think about how to organize your thoughts, how to establish a topic sentence, how to properly cite a quote mm-hmm. and other data. I don't see why these things are mutually exclusive.
I think she would say, this is on 314, referring to studying literary texts.
Mm-hmm.
She says, simply recognizing or appreciating these conventions is not enough. I'm at the wrong spot. Here's where I'm sorry.
We are juggling a lot of sources today.
She writes, it is simply not the case that interpreting texts, i.e. literary texts, will help students gain confidence in interpreting the results of a chemistry experiment, a field experience in a psychology class, or a sculpture. These contexts all assume different kinds of interpretation. And so Lindman seems to be saying that we should be teaching students in freshman composition how to interpret all kinds of texts that they will encounter across the curriculum, such as, I guess, results of a chemistry experiment and how to write like a scientist, primary historical data, and then how to write like a historian, and so forth.
Sure, I think we can find agreement there that it's important to be able to interpret data, but what better place than literature to study the unknown,
mm-hmm.
the abstract, the human element, to make mm-hmm. room for both order and chaos.
Yeah.
I just think these skills are applicable
mm-hmm.
to writing a chemistry, bio lab report.
Sure.
I don't see the...
Yeah, it's a fallacy, right? It's either or. It's a problem.
Yeah.
It's a problem. I think, too, that there might be this sense of literature in the composition class as if we're talking about teaching it as a literature survey course, which
mm-hmm.
of course that is not the function of the composition classroom.
Right.
And some of what I do agree with in her argument is where she does talk about the workshop, I guess, that there's just actively always writing going on,
uh-huh.
That it's not lecture heavy or reading heavy. It's writing heavy. And so I agree with that.
Right.
But again, I'm with you all where I feel like literature does have a place in that. And I think like on 314 in that second paragraph where she starts talking, poses the question, but doesn't studying literature help teach style? And she says, I don't think so. But then she goes a couple sentences later, she says, if our students were writing poems or short stories or even dialogues, literary models might suggest stylistic options worth practicing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it seems like she really doesn't have as much of a problem with teaching literature, but rather with literature teachers, at least of her time, the way conventional literature classes.
Right.
Like, just right above where you just read, if students get to write a paper or two, they must assume the disembodied voice of some abstruse journal as they analyze the ingrown toenail motif in Beowulf. Such assignments silence students' voices in conversation, in the conversation literature is intended to promote. I agree. That sounds like, right. I'm with Lindemann there. That sounds like a bad class.
Right. You know? But that's an unfair depiction of what teaching literature in a composition class can look like.
Strongman, right?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And look at us using our rhetorical analysis skills.
We don't hate we don't hate rhetoric. Yeah. Okay? We just want to make a little room for literature as well, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I agree with the points y'all made on style. I have both of those sections highlighted myself. Doesn't studying literature help teach style? I don't think so. I do think so. Mm-hmm. I think that you can study sentence structure, syntax, diction, all through you know reading literature.
Yeah.
These are things that have certainly helped me become a better writer as I think about my process.
Yeah, I think too though, like some of her literary references suggest to me that she's thinking of literature from times where like the English is different. Right? The use of English is different. I think it kind of ignores the value of contemporary literature.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I did, this is where I made a note and I said, perhaps that's because in 1993, the internet was just going public.
Yeah.
And now we have access to all of this, these contemporary voices.
Yeah.
They're just at our fingertips now, where before students would have had to like seek out literary magazines, you know, and like, or had a teacher that was hip in that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I think, when we're thinking about literature, but I still think there is value in looking at how Shakespeare used words.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You're not going to hear me say anything bad about the Bard on this podcast. Yeah.
Kind of class that Erica Lindemann wants, and also the kind of class described in another a response or a comment on Lindemann and Tate's paper by Kate Chinnock from the mm-hmm. year later. So it seems like the kind of I'm going to read a couple of quotes here to sort of get a sense of the kind of class that they want.
Okay,
a freshman writing course linked to a freshman history course, for example, gives students practice reading and writing history. So does a first year writing course. That asks students to read and write a variety of texts found in the humanities, sciences, and social sciences. To jump over to Chinnock, this is on 586 of her paper. She says, for example, while a student may gain by osmosis the awareness that scientists write in the passive a good deal, she will be in control of this knowledge only if she knows that this preference reflects the scientific ideal that the agent of the experiment is irrelevant, the procedure itself being primary. And then flipping to another section of hers from 588, this needs to be discussed because often the teachers within the discipline will not point it out to new students. They may not even have articulated it to themselves since they are so familiar with their discipline that its ways of proceeding appear obvious and its discourse transparent. So my question to Chinnock and Lindemann is why isn't that the problem? Right, that science teachers and history teachers are not communicating to their students how to compose in their discipline's dialect. It just seems like a lot of weight on the freshman comp teacher to understand all of those different dialects of composition.
That's a great point. Yeah, I think about like the breadth of our courses as a strength, mm-hmm. but here you're pointing out like a pretty difficult task that's ahead of us. Yeah. To be able to teach in all different genres and across curricula.
Yeah. If I wrote, if writing about history is an important part of studying history, then the history teacher should teach how to write about history. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Why is
or have a TA or an AI coach in there
for sure,
or just an embedded writing coach.
And if the answer to the question of why is it on the comp teacher's shoulders is that, well, writing is writing. You're the writing teacher. Well, then that goes back and defeats the original point that all kinds of writing are not preparing us for all kinds of writing. Rather, all kinds of reading are not preparing us for all kinds of writing.
For all kinds of writing. Yeah. I think I kind of want to quote good old Peter Elbow, also in, what is it, Chanak?
Chanak.
Chanak's article. Identifying the central principle of his own teaching, Elbow writes, "I cannot teach students the particular conventions they will need for particular disciplines, but I can teach students the principle of discourse variation. I can't teach them the forms they'll need, but I can sensitize them to the notion of differences in form so that they will be more apt to look for cues." And I this kind of planted the question in my mind as I continued reading this article, and to come back to the part that you just cited, Mason, about osmosis, is I put in the margin here the question, how can literature help make this visible to students so that she will be in control of this knowledge only if she knows that this preference reflects the scientific ideal and the agent of the experiment is irrelevant? How does teaching literature, using literature in our composition classroom, help the student who will be the scientist to understand the value that's reflected in the language choices of that style of writing?
Do we think, I mean, is teaching literature capable of revealing those kinds of formal disciplinary conventions? I'm not sure that it does, but I'm also not sure that we need to be responsible for communicating those conventions.
Yeah, I think my mind goes more as we think about how studying literature helps the undiscovered scientific luminary of our age is in their ability to connect with the public, with patients, with other people, their ability to understand how humans interact and communicate. I mean, I think that's where our value is, more so than how to write in the conventions of that particular field.
Well, I guess my thought on that kind of goes back to that the idea of sensitizing students to difference. And so thinking about what we've been doing during this semester with imitation, and some students are imitating poems and others are imitating an open letter and others are imitating, you know, more traditional type of narrative, that they're like, we've had a lot of conversation about difference and how the different literary genres they have their own cues and they have their own forms and I do think that needs to then be like contextualized with other academic writing, but that it's already laid the groundwork for that conversation, because I think like if you lay a bunch of academic articles out on a table, nothing is going to distinguish them until you dive in and you start actually reading and like discovering, oh, this is a scientific article, oh, this is a sociological article, you know, like it's so, but like you have to, I don't know. For me, I feel like it's helped to lay that groundwork for that conversation.
Right, right. So if you are teaching a comp class that involves a lot of literature and a variety of literature, including scholarship and such, right, then you are preparing them for the idea that a different kind of text has a different purpose, has a different audience. And you should adjust your voice appropriately based on the purpose in the audience. And I think teaching composition with literature can absolutely, just as you said, make that point. And that seems like to satisfy really what Lindman and Chanak really want, is that variety, that adaptability to write in different fields.
Again, you're pointing out that like the distance between literature and rhetoric is not as wide as they would have you
absolutely
believe.
Absolutely. No.
These types of rhetorical decisions are exactly what we're trying to train our students to do.
Totally.
Yeah.
So can we come back then to that question that Tate asks about why we are denying our students the pleasure and profit of reading this literature? Like what do you think is going on there?
Why hide the good stuff? I don't know. I can't find the reason either. Do you have theories?
Is it just an attitude, right? A pervading attitude that literature, teaching literature, is like easy, you know?
And yet it's reserved for the upper level classes in English.
Or is it the attitude, like I think Lindemann addresses in her first paragraph, that composition really should be a service class? It should be serving the other disciplines rather than, I don't know, have its own ends.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Offering students the one chance in their entire life to read something really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it was Tate that points out, and I don't know if I have it marked, that if a composition class doesn't have its own ends, then it's a waste of time.
What's it doing? Yeah. Mm-hmm. What is it doing? And I mean, we've been asking ourselves that question a lot, I think, as a department, right? Like, yeah. What are we doing? I don't know if I have an answer, like why is it not mm-hmm. And it's not in textbooks. I mean, there might be like the literary analysis chapter mm-hmm. in like an English 102 book, but then like that's exactly the kind of writing that's problematic according to mm-hmm. you know Lindemann. Right. And I don't think that's even maybe what we're talking about in terms of like why we bring literature into our class. Do we want to talk more about the literature that we like to share with our students and why?
Yeah, we have an example today, right? We're going to read, or not read the whole thing, but we have read.
Yes,
assuming we were all good students beforehand.
Uh-huh, we were.
Yeah, but I forgot my homework at home.
I see Monica scrolling through her.
I dropped mine on the floor.
Oh, my God. I thought, what are we, back in English 110 class?
Yes.
I thought I was with professionals this afternoon.
Okay.
My dog ate it.
Oh, it's sitting on my desk.
Sitting,
All right. Well, tell us what you brought for us, Andrew.
I brought a work by a very minor author of the Harlem Renaissance. I'm kidding, of course. We're going to look at Langston Hughes's short story "Thank You, Ma'am," and it's a story that I like to teach for two reasons mainly. I guess one, I think on its surface, it's a nice story for a beginning reader mm-hmm. to identify just some major themes and ideas, and yet it's still rewarding for mm-hmm. the reader who wants to go beneath the surface and find those deeper, more thoughtful, symbolic images.
Yeah. For someone who might not have read this story, can you give us a quick summary?
So this story has two characters, Mrs. Luella Bates Washington Jones, who is an elderly lady who's on her way home mm-hmm. from a hard day at work, and she is met with Roger, who attempts to steal her pocketbook. And the story takes off from there.
Mm-hmm. I wrote some questions, I think, to integrate this with the scholarship a bit. One thing that Lindemann says about teaching literature, and I think she does have a point here, that often leads to more discussion and less writing. Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm curious, as a teacher who's taught this a lot, what mm-hmm. do students end up writing as a result of having studied Thank You, Ma'am?
I think when I'm teaching literature and thinking of writing assignments that go along with it, I try to steer students toward finding a golden line, mm-hmm. a quote in the text mm-hmm. that they find mm-hmm. meaningful, mm-hmm. and then expanding upon what that quote means, why it matters, how it relates to a major topic, and then kind of introducing the idea of like a topic sentence, a concrete detail which will take shape and mm-hmm. as a quote, and then your commentary on what that means before you conclude. Yeah,
I mean, that's got interpreting evidence, connecting it to larger ideas,
right?
And those are very applicable.
A fairly sound.
Yeah, I like that it's kind of open. Like mm-hmm. It's just drawing on the golden line and then letting the student mm-hmm. explore the meaning.
Sure. Yeah.
Make the student can make the meaning from that experience. Well,
that brings me to that next thing. A phrase that Chinock uses a lot is knowledge making.
Knowledge making, yeah.
A composition class should show students how different disciplines make knowledge out of primary sources or, mm-hmm. or evidence or data mm-hmm. or whatever, right? And so is there a way that students can make knowledge from a piece of literature like this?
I guess one thing that students usually identify, you know, fairly mm-hmm. quickly is that it's a story about second chances.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then I guess from there, we'll try to explain what that second chance means mm-hmm. in terms of, like, our social interactions with yeah. others mm-hmm. and then why that's significant before diving into some, you know, more specific details.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what does the second chance mean?
The second chance means that we should treat people with compassion mm-hmm. rather than with discipline.
Yeah.
Well, how do our characters interact with each other, I guess? Like, how do we know that this is about second chances? Mm-hmm. Is there a golden line from this story that captures that moment?
Yeah, I think there are several. I thought I was going to ask questions here. In addition to second chances, one of the main ideas in the story, I think, is expectations being challenged. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, we expect 9 times out of 10 the young boy to successfully steal the pocketbook from mm-hmm. the older lady. Mm-hmm. He doesn't. We expect, once he fails to do so, that she will call the cops, take him to jail. She doesn't. Instead, mm-hmm. she takes him home. Mm-hmm. Once home, perhaps we expect her to put him in a room, lecture him, scold mm-hmm. him. Instead, she provides warmth, a meal, mm-hmm. opportunity to change.
I expected he might, like, maybe become more aggressive or try to steal something from her home.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was reading. Yeah.
Right. And we have that scene where he is tempted once again. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's a scene that we'll try to look at in class and then try to explain why does he not do that? When does he change? Uh-huh. And then back up and try to locate that moment where he washes his face yeah. mm-hmm. and suggest that there's some sort of spiritual cleansing sure. that's happening
yeah.
there.
Yeah, and when mm-hmm. you asked about symbolism, that part is what came to mind, like, mm-hmm. right. is the washing of the face.
Mrs. Washington Jones also says she's been hungry, too, uh-huh. and she's, but she didn't snatch people's pocketbooks. And then she cuts yeah. herself off, and she says, "You expected me to say that, but I didn't." Or she admits that she too mm-hmm. has, you know, done things that she's, you know, not proud of.
Yeah.
And so I think there is the moment that we try to get students to realize that what Roger wants is not a new pair of shoes, uh-huh. but the feeling yeah. that someone has been in his shoes.
Right.
Yeah.
That empathy, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. is what he's after.
Having just read Lindemann and Chinock and Tate, mm-hmm. I was really coming at this as, okay, so how does this, right, prepare the student who reads it to prepare them for the academy, right? That's what Chinock and Lindemann really want.
Sure.
So, not just them, right? They, of course.
Yeah, how does it tie to, how do you connect mm-hmm. it with the learning outcomes of our course, Andrew?
SLOs.
I guess
I'm just going to wear them on a t-shirt.
Something that stood out to me, I guess, though, is how does this text not teach you something about history or psychology mm-hmm. or criminal justice, mm-hmm. right? Other disciplines. Mm-hmm. And then if it is relevant to those, can we not train for those disciplines through the vessel of the literature, right? Writing about criminal justice through Thank You, Ma'am. Writing about history, right? The time period that this is yeah. set through Thank You, Ma'am.
Right.
All mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. And I think one thing that maybe the authors overlook is that literature brings all of those disciplines to life.
That's good.
Right.
The history is right here. Right? Right. When you read it, you're in it.
You're in it. Yeah.
So yeah, that's what really was on my mind as I finished reading this piece.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
I was just really surprised that this was the piece that you sent us, because I see you teaching so many other literary works, I guess, like in our little window that we share.
Yeah. Well, maybe season three, we hope we'll come back for more.
Yeah, another taste.
But so this is in your 101, 110.
Right, but I think it's applicable for any, you know, class.
Yeah.
I
When do you bring it in? Like beginning, middle, end? Like how do you?
This semester, I started with this early on in the semester. But, you know, sometimes it's at the end. Mm-hmm. I think that just, you know, depends on, you know, mood and inspiration for any given semester. I find that while I like to repeat a lot of the same text and assignments, just mixing them up, it's just kind of beneficial. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If this were in your class, Monica, what do you think you might do with it?
Well, that's a good question. You know, one of the things that I like about this story is the how much the dialogue pushes the story along. And I think it would be a great piece for imitation practice and like helping students with quotation, you know, quotation. And like, I like the golden line, the golden quote, but also just having students practice writing dialogue and sort of playing with voice a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I think something like that, but I like also what you were just talking about, like how can we draw connections between this and other academic disciplines that students might be heading into in the future. So I'd have to think a little more, like what would that look like? You know, how can you steer them?
Right. I mean,
or use this as an inspiration for them to design a project.
Yeah.
In that direction.
I mean, if this is the presumably the 1930s,
right? I don't have that year listed. Well,
You know, could a student write ostensibly, you know, having read maybe things in addition to "Thank You, Ma'am," said in the 1930s? Could a student write a history kind of a article, whatever they want to write, a history thing? That would be acceptable and preparatory for a history program, using the literature almost as like a primary source of the facts and the lifestyles. And
seems like a great assignment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you use it?
Thinking out loud. That was it.
That was it. Okay. All right.
But no, of course, imitation as well. I mean, that's been our big thing lately, and I think. It still is for me. It's it accomplishes that thing that both I think Lindemann and Chinnock want, and Tate I'm sure I think as well, where students practice a variety of kinds of composition, right? And you know, stepping into the shoes of another writer and trying to write like them, or to write something inspired by this piece, I think. Trains them to look at the purpose and the audience of a text and how they can adjust their choices for that purpose and that audience.
Andrew, could we go back to when we were first starting to talk about Lindemann's piece? I think you had read a brief line from her, but then I think you were also responding to what the excerpt that you had shared. And I wonder if you could repeat your response again. I feel like you said a lot of good stuff in there, but it went by so quickly.
Yeah.
And
we can return to that. I believe she says that... English teachers argue that poetry, fiction, and drama offer essential training in the process of reading. And I would add that it does, yes, but it also provides essential training in the process of understanding humanity, people's motivations, why people do what they do, why people think what they think, understanding their worldview, how they're shaped by environment or other external influences, so on and so forth. And then, the possibility of, you know, characters and humanities, bridging that gap to connect.
Mm-hmm. And you need to have a grasp of humanity no matter what discipline you go into, right? Not just the humanities, right? You need to understand people, right?
I think so, yeah.
And literature helps you understand people, understand yourself.
There's 8 billion of them, so probably have a...
And yet that seems to be the area that takes the hardest hits when higher ed decides, you know, when administrations decide what's important, that there's just been this sort of constant shaving away at the humanities that to me feels connected to, in a way, the, like the rhetoric police, as Tate puts it, that this... that there's something a little more sinister afoot in my, my intuition tells me there's something kind of sinister here. Mm-hmm. And there was a line, and I think it was in Lindman, about the problem that she sees with the literature is the, like, you know, the focus of the comp course is that then it just becomes about consuming and not about creating.
Yeah.
But I think that that's a problem that I think our experiment was responding to.
Exactly.
Because I don't, even though it, like, these textbooks are not literature, it's also just about consuming these examples of writing that's just really only for, like, classroom transactional purposes, which I'm also wondering, how is that actually helping you to learn how to connect with people, with yourself, to have a better understanding of yourself and to be able to understand the cues that you're going to encounter when you take other classes and you're asked to do different things, to be able to navigate that.
Well, I don't think we have to look too long at the outside world to notice that people have a tough time connecting with themselves and with others.
Yeah.
And I think there is a correlation between a lack of study of the humanities and literature. I just know for myself, as I think about becoming interested in English as a field, the reason was because I would read something that expressed exactly how I felt without knowing how to say it.
Yeah. Right.
And then seeing that on the page, I just found, like, inspirational, like foundational to understanding a little bit more about life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And as far as, like, then feeling like you're a part of something, you're not just, like, isolated
you're not alone.
And alone.
Yeah.
So I think even just as community building, it's a good a good tool for that.
It's nice to see that other people feel the same way and that others can say it so much better than you can. Right?
Yeah.
That's just so true.
Yeah.
Well, I think, something I think that all three of the authors we've discussed today, at least I think they all said some form of this. We don't like when we're just preparing students how to be in college, right? Where, you know, it's like, or, you know, is that right? They're not we don't just want to prepare them for doing this.
To be a good student, to be a good human. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. It's what comes after that matters. Yeah. And yeah, I think this study of being human is really one of the most essential foundation points, and a lot of our students are at the station in their lives where they need the foundation before they can start building.
Yeah, and I think with the rise of AI and all of that, the question of humanity is becoming ever more important to keep kind of at the forefront of conversation. Mm-hmm. But that might be another episode.
Stay tuned.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew, for joining us.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. That was great. Great conversation. Great juggling of paperwork here, papers.
And of course,
thank you, listener. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the English 101 Experiment. Special thanks to Christopher Nicotera, instructor of music business at Delgado Community College, for his recording assistance. All music heard during this episode comes from the Free Music Archive. Specific titles and artists are listed on the English 101 Experiment website.